Thank Giulio Chiribella and Rob Speckens for inviting me here and organizing this wonderful conference. Is going to be a pillar reference point for future research in quantum foundation. And I'm always happy to come back to this Perimeter Institute. I've been here so many times now, and it became kind of a reference point for my research, and I hope it will stay so in the future. And here I can meet many people with whom I can exchange ideas, and people like Lucien and Chris that influenced my work so much since the beginning. Say the work of Lucien, this 2001, about the derivation of quantum theory from five simple principles, and the work of Chris, quantum theory as information is a little bit more, and actually also converted me to Bayesianism. And I should say that times go so fast. Since 2005, I presented the first conjectured set of axioms for quantum theory. I started this work in 2003, and I continue lonely for many years, try to take my young collaborators off of this dangerous research, moneyless, maybe not good for academic career. But unfortunately, I was not able not to infect with the virus of quantum foundation these two guys, Paolo Perinotti and Giulio Chiribella, and without whom I would have never been able to reach the final set, complete set of axioms. And because I naively thought that it was going to be much easier to derive quantum theory, and it was not. And now we have a set of axioms. Maybe it's not the only one. Actually, it's not the only one. We've seen many other sets of axioms. Lucien, Massanes, Bruckner, and other. And maybe it's not the optimal. These are not the optimal one. It's not the axiom that Chris Fuchs is looking for. Maybe this axiom does not exist. We don't know. But still, there is a lot of work to be done. And for sure, what we learn a new way of reasoning without Hilbert space by just pure reasoning. So we became able to prove a little epistemological theorem, let me say. So there is a lot of work to be done in this direction. But we need to move on. And as Lucien said in his talk, this is a slide from his talk, we need to engage with the big problems in physics. Mostly the big problem is now quantum field theory. It's field theory, actually, the operational field theory, as he is looking for. And the situation now is again, as 10 years ago, there is a total scratch. There is nothing, almost nothing there. And let me say that at the very beginning of this research, I didn't feel easy, you know, in really taking me and other people seriously about this new idea coming out. No? But I discovered that actually this is the big lesson that I learned from all this experience, is that we really need to take ourselves seriously. When we do fundamental research, we get some idea that we believe is a good idea, some philosophical principle that we really want to pursue, we need to pursue up to the end seriously, and following the logical argument up to the extreme, and something will come out. That's my experience. So please let me take me seriously now. And so the situation with quantum theory is comfortable. It's like a cozy home. We are dwelling on discussion about realism, about locality, about causality. The situation with quantum field theory is horrible. It's a jungle. So we are parachuting in a jungle. We cannot see the sun. We don't know where we are aiming to. And we are totally alone. But we need really to get out this house that we are dwelling too much and have the courage of entering this jungle. So the situation is much more difficult. We have a problem which is much more difficult than that of just axiomatizing quantum theory. And today, what I'm going to show you is that the informational paradigm can be much more helpful in understanding foundation than what we can imagine. We can see that a lot of physics can be recovered as emergent from an informational processing. There are, for example, notions like the inertial mass, which is a big mystery in physics, and space-time, and though with relativistic covariance, notion of Hamiltonians, and we can even see that the notion of gauge boson, maybe neutrino, and gravity, we can have routes to follow for gravity, just by pursuing systematically, consistently, the same philosophical idea. And I'm not going to talk about the operational quantum field theory that Lucien was pointing as a new target, because this is really too difficult. I hope it will be the topic of my next talk next time I come here. But let me say that 50% of the talk that I'm presenting today is true also for a generic operational framework, field framework, as long as you assume at least one of the six axiom postulates that we have, which is causality. So the operational program of axiomatizing quantum theory has the main objective to get rid of Hilbert spaces. Now, in field theory, the mathematical monster that really we want to kill is the quantum field itself, especially the fermionic field, which is horrible because it's not measurable. It doesn't have a classical counterpart. And it suffers a kind of non-locality, which is the non-commutativity, which is much worse than that of entanglement. And we have a huge set of problems. Quantum field theory is affected not by, this is the least problem, the one of the renormalization. The worst is the localization. The localization means that we cannot even define a positional operator which is reasonable, but we cannot prepare local state. We cannot perform local measurement. It's, from the operational point of view, is a mess. And all these problems, most of them, come from the fact, from the continuum. We have also, for example, apparent, but still bad, violation of Einstein causality. Immediate delocalization of the wave function. We have that, for example, if you take the localized Newton-Wigner states, they immediately delocalize with an infinitesimal boost. All these things we don't want. We believe in causality. And all these problems can be solved if we take the operational framework, because the operational framework is discrete. We have boxes, distinct boxes, and they are connected by causal links. Now, we have a network. This network actually is going to be a quantum computational network because we are addressing just the quantum case. The gates that are the subroutines of the calculations represents deterministic events. and the wires represent the registers on which information is written, and they are the quantum systems. And the quantum systems are what? Are just causal links. Think the photon. What is the photon? We have it in the lab. We switch on the laser, and we hear a click in the detector, and we imagine a photon flying through the beam splitters as a causal connection between the two events. And something which I'm going to assume here is that the network is homogeneous, topologically homogeneous. So that there is what I call the physical law, which is represented by a set of causally connected events, by which, if I translate this set, I can recover the whole network. So this represents the physical law, which is true everywhere and ever. Now, the fact that I am looking for reality as emerging from this quantum computation is essentially the same idea of David Deutsch, who wrote, this is just the Church-Turing principle regarded as a physical principle. And this is more than that. It's not just a simulation of reality in the sense of David Deutsch. It's a new philosophy. It's a new approach. It's a new scientific approach. The approach is totally operational. Everything must be defined in terms of a protocol, of a measurement, like in the axiomatization of quantum theory. Is the same operational approach. But the events are the real entities, not the things, not the objects. Events are the facts that are expressed in the common language, the everyday language. And they are the interface between the common language, what happens in the lab, and the theory. They are the primordial notions. And formulating a theory is equivalent to have a set of causal connection between events such that I can connect local events here with local events there, connects events in the past with events in the future, preparations, local preparation with local observations. And let me say that there are really only events. Events don't happen in space and time. They make space and time. Space and time emerges from the events in the sense that is a way of looking. Space and time are a way of organizing events. And this is actually not such a crazy idea if I say that Einstein said the same thing. This is a quotation that is not very well known. He says, time and space are modes by which we think and not conditions in which we live. And let me say something more, that also Einstein said that we are inferring causal connections. We are building up a theory of causal connections, but also remote events are inferred from previous experience. Or, more generally, we send a signal, the signal comes back in terms of another signal, and then we infer the event from previous experience, from previous inference about other events, and that's the way in which you solve the problem, for example, of against the measurement by Bell. You say, oh, how can it be? A million of years ago, there was nobody there to measure dinosaurs, right? We are inferring dinosaurs. And this is actually the way in which Einstein thought. Now, so the idea is that this quantum computation is what? It's a network of causal relation of all possible in principle happening events. So at the tiniest scale, this is the theory which must work. At the very tiniest scale, the Planck scale. So this is the true theory. Whereas the quantum field theory is what? It's an approximation, is an effective theory. And the fact that we are using a lattice is going to solve all the problems that I told you. This is actually what we can say without the need of proving a theorem. And the strong point in my way of looking at things is that it's not just a causal network of the kind of Raphael Sorkin, because I ask something more. I ask homogeneous topology. So in some sense, the causal networks of Raphael Sorkin are random. There are random and dynamical connections. In my case, the dynamical connection is the physical law. So it must be true everywhere, at every scale, is the microscopic physical law. And I ask something more. I ask that the quantum computation, which simulates reality, must be very efficient. And I will tell you now what I mean by efficiency. So I told you about the homogeneity. I want to stress a notion, is that since if I take the physical law means that, sorry, this set of events which corresponds to the physical law, you have to think them as different events. So is a plaquette of events A, B, C, D, and even the wires can be different. Now, if you merge them into a single event, then you undress the topology. This is not pure topology. In this case, you have a topology which is dressed with colors. You undress this topology by merging the events into a new network, which is pure topology. So this is the undressing procedure that I'm going to use next. And if ultra-efficient simulation means the following. I don't want to be able to cheat simulating reality with a computer which works actually in 10 dimensions. So what I ask is that the graph dimension of the computation is the same as space-time dimension, which means what? The graph dimension means is the dimension of the Euclidean space in which I can embed the graph in such a way that all causal links are segments of a straight line, all with the same length. This is a very strong requirement, like here in this case, is a very strong requirement because it implies locality, namely all gates are connected only to a finite and actually small number of systems, and you have more. So you have that the possible topologies are very few. You can classify them. For example, in two dimensions, you have only this topology, which is the square lattice, and this topology, which is the triangular lattice. For example, if you consider the hexagonal lattice, this is a dressed topology. It's not pure topology, because you have these two events here that are inequivalent. So if you merge them into a coarse-grained lattice, you get, again, the square lattice. So there are only two in two dimension, in one plus one dimension. And now you have these causal networks. You can do everything. You can predict the probability of every composite event. Here, for example, we have an event which is made of five events by composition and by coarse graining. And what you need to know, you just need to know the quantum state or the state of the operational framework for any slice at will of the causal cone. And that's the only thing you need. But physicists like to introduce something more, to have a vacuum. The vacuum here is a locally invariant global state, in the sense that each gate will not change locally the state. And then if you consider a global state which differs from the vacuum only by a local set of systems, then this state is very easy to evaluate the evolution of it, because, for example, in the quantum case, it would be just an isometric embedding of this local state into the tensor product. And the isometry comes from the fact that each gate will act on a fixed state of the vacuum, and on a variable state of this local state. And then you compose gates of this kind. So you compose isometries, and you get a big isometry. And this state is going to be a matrix product state. So the evaluation has a very low complexity, polynomial complexity. And this is equivalent to the first quantization. Now, but I think everybody is curious about how covariance emerges from the computation. This is actually something easier than what one can think. It's a free bonus of the computation, because at least in 1+1 dimension, you can see this at work very easily. The Dirac equations is nothing but the free flow of information. So in one dimension, information can flow only in two directions, namely left and right. And if it flows in a given fixed direction, it can flow only at maximum speed of one gate per step. Now, if you want to convert from this digital world in which there are only events and causal collection, pure topology, event counting, no metric, to the analog world in which we have a metric, you need a conversion from counting to meters and seconds. And these can be interpreted as the minimum distance between gates and the time duration of each event. And then the maximal speed of one gate per step become C, A divided by tau. And the evolution of the two fields, which can be operational fields in general, which describe the left and the right flow, will be given by this finite difference equation. So these are finite difference derivatives in general. Now, if you want to slow down the information in a systematic way as a physical law, the only way to do that is to have a periodic change of direction, like a zigzag, periodic zigzag motion. And the way to do that, heuristically, is to couple the two modes, phi plus and phi minus, by an imaginary constant, which is an angular frequency, which is the frequency of this zigzag. And that's the Dirac equation in 1+1 dimension without spin. And there is no need to impose covariance. So it's a nice game, but it's interesting, I think. Because this is actually why information does not need relativity. Actually, relativity is coming out from just pure quantum theory. And there is something more. I think this is interesting. We recognize that this is the inverse Compton wavelength. So this is proportional to the inertial mass. So we have a definition, a kinematical definition of inertial mass. This is something which I think is pretty relevant, because the inertial mass is, according to Max Jammer, this is a well-known author that probably most of you know, and this is one of his best books. Inertial mass is the big mystery of physics, because we have only circular definition. He says that we have a jump from kinematic to dynamics, and the only way to cover this jump is to have a kinematical definition of inertial mass. So information now allows us to define inertial mass kinematically as the slowing down of information, periodic change of direction of information. And if we take literally this, then the Compton wavelength becomes the equivalence between the rest energy, mc squared, and the Planck quantum. And h bar can be reinterpreted as the conversion factor between the inertial mass in seconds to the minus one, the informational definition, and the usual one in kilograms, which I think is interesting. But now, if you want, you can also see the spin, but this is not very important, because we want to see the spin four dimension. Anyway, it is easy to see that if you really want to achieve by physical mean this coupling, then you need gates. And if you have quantum gates, you need two different kinds of gates. One set are just swaps, and the other sets are SU2 transformation. So this is not pure topology. It's addressed topology. We want to unaddress the topology So that's the physical law. Undressing the topology, we get a new network which is equivalent to this one, but where each gate, the wires are doublets. And this is, if you want, a topological interpretation of spin. And by the way, you also have a practical realization in the lab of this network, because you just need swaps, namely nothing, and beam splitters. So for the experimentalist, maybe this can be fun. But when you really achieve this coupling between left and right by physical mean, this is going to be dependent on the specific operational theory. And in the case of quantum theory, what you find is that there is a renormalization of the speed of light, of the maximal speed, which is a function of the mass. So we have a refraction index of vacuum, which is a function of the mass. And this is actually a very simple phenomenon that comes directly from the unitarity, because the unitary matrix evolving the field has, in a row, there is an element which is C and another element which is the coupling, and there is a trade, since the normalization must be one of the row, there is a trade-off between the speed and the coupling. So if you increase the speed, you have to decrease the coupling and vice versa. And the interesting feature is that you have complete halt of the information. And if you take the distance between two gates, which is 2a, as the Planck distance, then you have total halt at the Planck mass. Now, but you want to see really how relativity emerges. Don't forget that causality is a partial ordering. These events are causally connected. There is an input-output relation between them. And there are events that are not causally connected. They are independent, like these two blue events. You cannot go from this to this by a causal path, because you have to go in the reverse output-input direction to connect them. So these are causally independent. Now, what is time? Time, and this is actually an idea that came from a very old work of Leslie Lamport, the inventor of LaTeX. Time can be regarded as a computer clock, a global clock, by which we synchronize the independent subroutines in a parallel distributed computation. And now, the idea is that you give a local rule to synchronize the subroutines, and you use this rule uniformly, and this rule is the equivalent of the boost. So, you classify the synchronized subroutines into leaves, and what you get is the computational equivalent of the Tomonaga-Schwinger foliation. Now, you stretch the circuit in such a way that all the leaves are parallel, so that the vertical axis represents the global clock, and these two circuits are the same circuit, the same topology, the same information processing. But now you can see the phenomenon that there is an increased density of leaves here and a more sparse set of events per leaf, which corresponds to the Lorentz time dilation and space contraction. And actually, if you want to be more precise, you have to consider the tick-tack of an Einstein clock of light bunching between two mirrors. And here you see you have 16 leaves, here 8, and one event distance and two events distance. That's the Lorentz time dilation and space contraction. But now there is a problem. And this actually is a work with Alessandro Tosini, who is here. You have seen his poster. Let's go. The problem is that we want to give a reference frame which is completely digital. And this, we get, there are constraints in giving integer coordinates. Actually, you get fractional coordinates. You don't want them. And the way to get out of this problem is to consider the same protocol that Einstein used to give coordinates, which is what? You send information from your clock to an event, and the information comes back to you. So this is this represents the most precise clock that you can imagine if this distance is the Planck distance, and this is the Planck time. And now you infer the time of this event and the position of this event by considering the middle event in the tick-tack of the clock. You can do this with another event like this, and you infer that this event happens at this time, and it is distance 3 steps, whatever. And you can do this with many, all possible events by shifting on the clock. But now, take these other events. You see the corresponding middle place is on the other side of the clock. But the observer, precisely, is only on this position, not on this one. So he cannot discriminate between this event and the other one. So you have a kind of a topological impossibility of discrimination, which give rise to a topological cross-graining. So you can give precise definition only of these events in this set, and the other events you can coarse-grain in such a way that you obtain the same network, but it's going to be a network of thick events. They are thick. And this is true, actually, already in the reference REST frame. And by the way, if you want, you can again think that this is a topological way of finding the spin, because you have doublets here connecting these events. And this is actually to be true also in a 3 plus 1 dimension. And if you have a boost, in the boost, what characterizes the boost is that the length of the tick and the tack are different in your clock, and you have a different coarse graining, and which gives this new integer reference frame. If you take an imprecise clock like this one, in which the tick and the tack are multiple of 2 steps, then you have more coarse graining because the clock is not precise. And in this way, you can recover an integer version, a digital version of the Lorentz transformation. It's very easy to do calculation in terms of this alpha and beta that are the relative lengths of the tick and the tack of the 2 clocks in the 2 reference frames. And here you see the composition of velocity, which you have in relativity for parallel velocity. Here it's only 1 dimension. And these are the digital version of the Lorentz transformation. You must have an additional constant here because this transformation must be integer. And you have the boost term, which is irrational. So there must be a compensation of this irrationality. And this comes from this constant. And this constant, by the way, is again a digital stuff because it can be... Oh, by the way, if I make... So this ratio is an integer number, right? And this constant, I would say, in this guy is a digital thing because it is the volume of the event calculated by counting the REST frame events inside that are contained inside. So that's the way to get, if you want, a digital version of relativity. But now we want to see the whole physics emergent. And one thing which is interesting is the Hamiltonian, because we don't have Hamiltonian here. There are only unitary transformations, because all unitary transformations are very far from the identity, like swaps. We have pure causality, absolute causality, no violation of causality. And the Hamiltonian can be recovered in this way. You take difference between the unitary matrix propagating forward and the unitary matrix propagating backward. And they can be different, like, for example, here, A and B are different. So this matrix will not be Hermitian. But since we have a physical law which is true everywhere and ever, the lattice must be periodic. So if you take sufficiently many steps, like here, you take 2 steps, you take the unitary matrix corresponds to 2 steps unitary evolution forward and 2 steps backward, then the Hamiltonian is Hermitian. So hermeticity is a consequence of the universality of the physical law. It's not an assumption. And you build up the operator Hamiltonian in this way, and this gives exactly evolution of the field. By the way, in this way, you can even recover the Lagrangian. So there is a dequantization. We start with pure quantum theory and come back to classical notions. But the most interesting feature is the fact that you can really eliminate the fields. I show this in one dimension now. Actually, this construction needs one dimension, but then I'm going to talk about more dimension. The problem is that the unitary operator that gives the unitary linear evolution of the fields are exponential in bilinear products of the fields that are neighboring wires, the left and the right fields. This is the swap. Now, if you want to write, okay, the case of the bosonic field is trivial. If you want to write down the fermionic field in terms of a qubits operator, the only way to do that, in order to get the anti-commutation, is to build up one-dimensional, infinitely long strings of sigma Z Pauli matrices, where the head of the string is a sigma minus or a sigma plus. And they anti-commute, because you always have a sigma minus against a sigma Z. And then if you substitute, because of the one-dimensional construction, if you substitute this here, since these are next neighbor, all the sigma Z cancel, and you are left with sigma plus and sigma minus of the qubits that are the wires of the gate. This construction works only in one dimension. I'm going to tell you more about more dimension. And you have other interesting things, like, for example, you have automatically non-abelian gauge theory, the gauge invariance, which is the fact that you have different Hilbert spaces for each wire, and they are totally unrelated. You want to connect them by a unitary transformation. It will be a unitary transformation depending on the wire, right? And these can be programmed by another field. And if you take everything literally, the Nielsen and Chang theorem says that if you want to program a unitary, you cannot do it by finite dimension. So you need infinite dimension. So if you want, the boson gauge field must be boson. Must be boson, because it must be infinite dimensional. Now, if we go to larger dimension, to more than 1 plus 1, things become much more complicated. In 3 plus 1 dimension, for example, the minimum gate would be minimum number of system gate would be four-partite. It's like a pentahedron, is the four-dimensional version of the simplex. Pentahedron up and pentahedron down, connecting four wires and four wires. And this actually automatically gives the spin. This is a stereographic representation, and this is a 3D projection of this simplex, four-dimensional simplex. And this is going to be the lattice that you have corresponding to space in the rest frame. But there are problems rising that look like obstruction to digitalization if you go to more than one dimension. One problem, for example, is the fact that you have a digital anisotropy of the speed, of the maximal speed of information. If you take the set of events that have the same minimum given distance from a given event, like here, for example, this set of events have one step distance, this set of events have two steps distance, and so on, you see that these sets are not approaching the circle. So there are directions like the diameters of this hexagon where the information goes fast, more fast. So you cannot just make, you know, an interpolation by saying, oh, okay, there is a, I convert event counting into meters by, no, you cannot do that. You need more. And I have not studied yet this problem, but for example, I can tell you one thing, that first, if you go to more general networks, the situation can be even worse. You have a star-shaped instead of the convex sets. But a way out could be, for example, the fact that you have a refraction index which depends also on the direction, And this is due to the fact that you are coupling different direction in the gate, or just the fact that you consider, for example, a widely delocalized wave state over many, many, many systems, and so the delocalization of the states doesn't feel the discreteness. And actually, this is what happens in the Birula approach. Birula has a kind of, has a very old paper about cellular automata simulation of field theory, in which you get this by having a very delocalized wave function. But another problem, clearly, is that you want to restore continuous symmetry, and you start from something which is not. And one way out is the thickness coming from the topological coarse graining, or, again, the fact that you have widely delocalized wave functions. And maybe if you have a very, very localized wave function, you can see the discreteness. And but the most interesting thing, this is really amazing, is that the Jordan-Wigner construction that I show you before, or this long string of Pauli matrices in order to get anticommuting fields, works in one dimension. If I go to two dimensions, what I need to do to build up these fields? I need to build up, I can do that, but I need to build up a snake, a one-dimensional snake covering the two dimensions. But now the problem is that if I take two fields that are close each other along the snake, when I multiply them, all the Pauli matrix disappear, and you are left with sigma plus and sigma minus, and that's okay. But if I couple, if I have products of two fields, one here and one here, they are close in the other direction, then I have a trouble. I have all the sigma z on this u, right? But this problem, unbelievably, has been already solved by Chirac and Verstraete in a paper that is pretty unknown. And the way out is to add another field, which is actually a real Dirac field, is a Majorana field, and build up the snake or something analogous in such a way that you really can convert bilinear expression in local fields into bilinear and plus a multiplication with a local set of Pauli matrices. And you see all these Pauli matrices are pertain the same gate. So you are just adding system to the same gate. But the topology is the same. Topology is the same. And I think this is amazing because, you know, the dream is that you see, anyway, it's a game, but there is a kind of informational motivation for the neutrino. So, anyway, you see a mechanism by which some things that look completely unrelated to quantum information can come out. And let me conclude with the fact that if you really believe in this informational approach, and if you really believe in the equivalence principle, that the gravitational mass is the same as the informational inertial mass, then it seems to me that the only way out is to think to gravity as an emergent quantum effect, as a quantum effect. And actually, this is exactly, I think, is exactly the idea of the Verlinde-Jacobson approach as a gravity, not as a fundamental force, but as a macroscopic force, as an entropic force. And the three ingredients that you need in this theory are the notion of entropic force, which is very simple, the Uhuru effect, which is also very simple, and the holographic principle. This is the part that it is very intriguing, because what we need to prove it is that we need a mechanism by which the information is completely constrained to the causal horizon. So there must, we need a kind of a quantum evolution which puts the information on the causal horizon. And that's all. So I just want to conclude. I hope that we got the idea that by pursuing this idea of information and everything emerging from information can go much more far than what we can think at the beginning. We can even discover maybe the neutrinos or a new different kind of quantum gravity. Thank you very much for your patience.
Are there any questions, comments?
So when you define the vacuum state of the discrete field, you define it as a state that is invariant?
Locally invariant.
Locally invariant, but if I saw it correctly, it was assumed it was a product state.
It's a product state.
So because...
It's not entangled.
Okay, so how does it... So how do you compare this with the thing that in quantum field theory typically used?
This is actually also in... wait a minute. In quantum field theory, the entanglement is a different kind of entanglement. We don't have localized systems.
So in quantum field theory, different regions, the vacuum state is entangled between different regions.
But that's another thing. This is another feature coming from the continuum, that you can never disentangle portion of space that have a point in common in the closure. That's another kind. It is not the same system. This is a feature coming from the continuous. This is a discrete case. There is a theorem by Gandhi, which is about what should be the vacuum in a computation which cannot compute the Hald function in a field theoretical description like this one, who says that it must be factorized. So look something different from what we know.
So you expect that it's a mathematical feature that is not really physical. I mean, if one tries to...
It is a mathematical feature. Is it a mathematical artifact? Actually, this is why we cannot prepare local states. It's horrible.
What testable prediction does your theory make?
I don't understand the question.
What testable prediction does your theory make?
Oh, there is one testable. There are many testable predictions. So we have violation of Lorentz covariance because of the discreteness. We have this refraction index of vacuum that, in principle, can be proved in the sense that all these things happen at the Planck scale. They are supposed to be true at the Planck scale. But there is a huge literature about this kind of violation, and there are hopes that we can see this violation in the cosmic rays, for example, this very energetic cosmic rays. I'm not an expert of this field, but, for example, certainly Lise Molin, I know, for example, in Italy there is Giovanni Amelino Camelia, that are making theoretical predictions through violation of Lorentz covariance, coming from this discreteness or violation of, like this one, of the refraction index of the vacuum depending on the mass, that may explain very energetic cosmic rays that cannot be explained by the standard model, for example. So in principle, there are. But this is just an idea. Speak slowly.
Okay. So I really like this idea, this direction. And so I think having unitarity and locality and discreteness is very good. But one, the way you set up your model, you couldn't... So a natural kind of discrete, unitary, local thing would be shift everything to the left. But because of the way you've set up your causal network, that wouldn't fit, I think, directly in your model. You'd have to do it by sort of swapping some things here and then in the next step doing some other part. So I just wondered a comment, really, how that fitted into your picture. Because it's not parallelizable. You couldn't do that in parallel, but it still seems very natural.
So what is not parallelizable?
The operation shift everything to the left by one square.
Oh, the shift operations,
yes.
For example?
Yeah.
Okay. What does it mean it's not parallelizable? This is a global group, discrete group?
So, I mean, the way your model works out, you have a unit tree on these two systems, and then and a unit tree on the next two systems, and a unit tree on the next two systems, but there's no global connection. So you'd have to
Local connection. Global connection. That's a good thing. Otherwise, you don't have a causality. So the problem is that when you have an Hamiltonian, which is global, you are in trouble, because even though it is made of next neighbor terms, local terms, when you take the exponential, you have the square, which gives no local effects everywhere. So the locality is crucial to have a causality, right?
I agree with that, but clearly shift everything to left by one is not uncausal. It seems causal. But anyway, we can talk about it later.
So, but the only way to get causality is to have total locality of interactions. That's the only way. Otherwise, you violate causality in some way. There is no way out. Or you have randomness in the causal connections or things like that. You have to go to these kind of tricks. But if it's something which is exact, like a physical law, true at every scale, every time, everywhere, not a random law, must be like that. Maybe I didn't understand your question.
Okay, so we thank Mario again.
Thank you.
We reconvene.